ship is lost in a nebula.
We go in with a shuttle.
Flying with nothing but hope and a prayer. Are you really that crazy? Good to know.
You launched an unauthorized rescue mission.
I'm trying to win a war.
And don't make enemies on your own side.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, getting groovy and feeling way cool.
Okay, and we have a very special guest here to offer some of his katra to all of you out there, Carmen Cartunuto.
Hello.
Carmen, this is the first time you've been on the show. I have to ask you, so far, are you digging Star Trek Discovery since the premiere? Not the first time you've been on the show, but this first time since the premiere.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I am. I am. Oh, yeah. My complaints with it are few and far between. I'm very much enjoying Star Trek Discovery.
So, guys, why don't we dive into it? We're doing a bit of a recap review of Episode 6, Lethe.
That is correct.
Okay. And, Cam, we always want to try to do something a little bit different on the podcast. What is kind of the theme that we're tackling in our review of Lethe?
Right. So we bounced around some topics to kind of bring Discovery, you know, this episode into the canon of Star Trek. And so we've decided to tackle daddy issues because, as we've seen in the past, Sarek, he has some issues as a father.
Yeah, who do you think exemplifies kind of the daddy issues in Star Trek?
I truly believe Spock is okay. The poster boy for Star Trek daddy issues.
And, well, Carmen, after this episode, Lethe, do you think that this kind of bolsters the argument that Sarek is responsible for a lot of these daddy issues?
I think he's outpaced only by Worf in the father department.
Who's a worse father, Worf or Sarek, guys?
Well, okay, there's two ways to look at this argument. One is sort of results-based. Who turned out better, Spock or Alexander? Obviously, Spock turned out a lot better. Now, Cybok then comes into the equation. He didn't turn out so well, but, you know, he's kind of shuffled off after one movie with never referenced again.
Or before.
Yeah, and I feel like Burnham is not going to turn out like a Cybok.
So, although she's never been referenced again.
So results-based, I'm going to give it still to Sarek because you produced Spock.
Okay.
However, the children that come out of this, you know,
they all seem pretty messed up.
Really messed up. And by quantity, there's 3 versus 1.
Yeah.
And so I really think that Sarek may be the worst father in Star Trek.
I would give it a vote for Sarek. What do you feel, Carmen?
I'm still going to go with Worf as bad father. At least Sarek keeps in contact with his kids, even through the vastness of space.
Yeah.
Oh,
do you think, you know, the character of Sarek, so much hoopla is made of him in the world of Star Trek. You know, in the series, he's always sick when we see him, including this week's episode.
And in his title episode on Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yes, yeah. Yes. You know, it was only the Battle of the Binary Stars and the Vulcan Hello he was actually in, you know, seemed well.
That's true. Well, the movies, too. He wasn't sick in the movies.
Right, exactly. Oh, yeah. Yeah, the movie's different. But, you know, he's dignified. We see he's an important Vulcan. But is he overrated? Because all we see is this guy making terrible mistakes.
But, okay, well, let's get into it, because this is kind of the crux of the episode, is we find out a lot of Burnham's backstory here with regards to her future in the Vulcan Expeditionary Group.
Yes,
Veg. Otherwise known as what, Veg. Cam? Veg?
Yeah.
Yeah. And we find out that, actually, she had the chance to join it, but Sarek kind of poo-pooed that in favor of Spock, which I find a very fascinating kind of revelation on their part.
Yeah. He kind of had to make a Sophie's choice.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Spocky's choice. we should just rename the podcast Spocky's Choice, Cam. But so essentially, we kind of find some big news about, because I had a lot of questions about how Burnham even ended up in Starfleet, because we knew that she didn't go through the academy.
Yeah,
she went through Vulcan Science Academy, not Starfleet Academy, and she somehow ends up on a Starfleet ship. And look, Sarek had to pull some strings and get her in, and is because of his own kind of deal making with that, was it Valarka, that old Vulcan dude?
I'm going to say yes.
Sure. Okay, yeah. We'll go with that.
Let's go with
fan favorite.
Yeah, so what does this really tell us about a guy like Sarek? Is he as cool as we thought?
Well, it really explains a lot about his affinity for humans. He seems a lot less perfect than any other Vulcan. He's definitely, he made this choice, which, you know, could very well be based on emotion. I mean, it
oh, yeah.
Like he went for his own flesh and blood over his ward.
He's trying to build bridges here, like show that humans could be equals to Vulcans, like theoretically, which Vulcans, I think we know, I think Enterprise probably did the best at developing Vulcans as we know it, even though I don't know how many people actually watched Enterprise.
Right, yeah.
But I think this kind of goes into a lot of the themes that we're seeing in Enterprise about, like, humans are just kind of these smelly creatures that are always going to be second-class citizens as far as Vulcans are concerned.
And it's like, you know, it's referred to in this episode that, you know, between Spock and Burnham, there's sort of these experiments of Sarek that he's trying to kind of push into Vulcan society. And, you know, I just wonder if, like, Sarek is like a cautionary tale to a certain degree of, like, sort of someone who's wants to fit into Vulcan society but has a little bit of a rebellious ideas, not necessarily to the degree we would see of some of the more extreme Vulcans, like, say, Cybok, or those ones from the Enterprise episode who are, you know, doing the melds that are against the rules of Vulcan society.
Right.
Fusion is the episode. You know, like, he's not like those type of Vulcans where he's, you know, a real extremist. But he's definitely got more outsider ideas.
So he's not quite Black Sabbath. He's more Jethro Tull. Is that?
He'll win the Grammy over Metallica.
Okay. Gotcha.
For Master of Puppets.
I don't know. Carmen, is Sarek kind of punk rock with regards to other Vulcans?
That's one way to look at it, I guess. He definitely has this experiment, like this sort of... this point he has to prove. I still think he loves his kid and his ward as much as, like, you know, a Vulcan can love someone. But he definitely also thinks that he can maybe double dip and raise two people and then also fulfill this experiment he has. I guess his grand idea is like, look, everyone, I've done it.
He's like, look, I completely failed with my full-blooded Vulcan son, Cybok. Yeah. What about these not quite Vulcans, as they're referred to in this episode, like, you know, Burnham or Spock?
Yeah, which is very prideful of him, I think.
Established who was older, Spock or Cybok?
Cybok,
yeah.
Cybok is older. Okay, yeah. So he got the middle one right. So the middle child was the one that he really triumphed with ultimately. When you look back at the career of Sarek,
whereas like middle children are typically the ones that are forgotten about. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you a middle child, Carmen?
No, I'm the oldest.
Same here.
There's only me and my brother.
Yeah, Cam too.
I am too.
Yeah. Okay, cool. But guys, why don't we jump into it? Because I really dug this episode. And one of my complaints, you know, Cam, you know, we've actually chatted about this. But
yeah, and I've agreed.
I don't feel as if I'm getting enough moments to just hang out with the crew and get to know them in slower sort of beats. I like the stuff where, you know, we see... It was Sylvia Tilly and Michael Burnham jogging through the corridors. You know,
right.
It felt very much like Learning Curve, one of my favorite Star Trek Voyager season finales ever.
Yeah. No, I mean, I really enjoy moments like that. I enjoyed the scene in the mess hall. There's a couple of them, but with Ash Tyler and Burnham, as well as Tilly in that first one. And I liked that we're seeing these characters who... You know, we've had issues where it doesn't feel like this crew really likes each other or really has any sort of camaraderie with one another because, you know, it's war in all capitals.
Yeah.
Whereas I felt like after this episode, this crew is starting to gel. I would have actually liked to have seen Stamets brought in a little more or Saru. Mm-hmm. But
Stamets was high. You know, there's only so much he could do. He's getting the munchies nonstop.
Yeah, yeah. But I like that we're seeing the hangout factor. You know, they're not quite doing their shore leave episode yet, where they're just like hanging out for almost an hour. But you know, we're getting there.
Fighting ninjas.
Yeah.
Actually, no, there was a lot of martial arts in this episode.
There was.
I don't know, Carmen. Lethe. How do you place this one so far?
Its pacing was a little too fast and jarring for me.
Okay.
It's not my favorite Discovery so far, but I do agree with Cam. I like how I like the hangoutness of it. I like the beginning hangout with Tilly and Burnham. I liked hanging out in the mess hall. And yeah, actually, that's true. That's one thing I've noticed is that the crew doesn't really seem to like each other. And I first chalked it up to Lorca kind of being a bit more authoritarian than other captains.
Yeah.
Yeah, they definitely said this Star Trek series, they were going to dispense a lot with the sort of, you know, Starfleet always gets along, which, you know, you could be debate whether is good or not, but yeah, I've noticed.
Was it good for drama? That's what people always question. Like, if there's no internal conflict,
mm-hmm.
how great is that for drama?
Yeah, I guess we'll see, like, how much better Discovery does with drama, but there's always kind of been drama in Star Trek, even going back to McCoy and Spock just kind of sparring with each other.
Definitely.
Yeah, but okay, I think that the original series is always known for the internal conflict, mm-hmm. but look, Roddenberry comes back with Star Trek The Next Generation. I think he wanted to change things up as if mm-hmm. humanity has progressed to a certain degree, and that's when he kind of said, like, no, they should not be fighting with each other. Conflict is coming from external forces, which does not necessarily make for great drama, and that's what we saw with a lot of season one and season two of Next Generation, and I think they kind of worked their ways around that, but that's why I think you had so many outsider characters in DS9, so that you could have kind of the Bajoran militia or the bartender creating a lot of the conflict yeah. there.
And you got little spikes of conflict in Voyager through Tom Paris.
Another guy with the daddy issues.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, of course, then there's that episode of Harry Kim, you know, going off at Janeway about being in love. Like, there was, like,
the disease.
You know, Voyager did follow more of the TNG template of the crew not or getting along all the time, but yeah, it did have moments. Like, it's at least admirable in that regard. It didn't completely, you know, bend to the everyone just gets along all the time sort of idea.
Sure. Why don't we dive into a little bit we're talking about the B story a little bit, the character moments, the beats that I think we all liked, but the overall A story, we talked about how Sarek maybe isn't the greatest father, but let's just talk about it from a narrative thread. Essentially, Burnham has to go do some neuroscience, long-distance Katra calling on the shuttle through a nebula,
yeah.
hook up with, you know, Sarek somehow in his brain. How does this, as maybe a story, work for you, Carmen?
He's very passionate about
this episode. I know. Well, he's a little too out there. Was it not gripping enough? Or, I don't know, because you mentioned the pacing. It went by really fast.
It did.
I noticed that as well, even though we had so many, like, small moments with the characters.
It seemed like the small moments were little islands in the rapids that was the plot of this episode. Wow, yeah. I don't know. This Katra connection that they have with Sarek is, or the Burnham has with Sarek, I should say, is pretty interesting. It's definitely pushing the Star Trek pseudoscience a bit more.
Yeah, a lot of fans have had an issue with that.
Yeah. Also, I don't know too much about the tension because we know Sarek lives and is fine.
Yeah, no, that's true. Like, at any moment, did we think that she would fail at this?
No, it was, in that regard, I guess it was more about the journey and...
Which maybe I kind of liked more. I liked finding out more about Burnham and how she got to where she is this point.
But does that make the whole kind of destination aspect of, or the ticking clock of this episode kind of just crappy? Because
yes,
it's ultimately completely superficial and kind of synthetic because we know nothing can come of this.
No, and it's weird because, Carmen, you bring up the pacing of this and it was quickly paced, but
that has been an ongoing issue for me with Discovery.
But I didn't feel tension here.
That's an issue, and it's not just Discovery. Other shows have done it too. I think a lot of it has to do with just TV. A lot of the time, you don't get a lot of series series that are very kind of slow and kind of take their time. More on, I guess, maybe HBO, things like that. But I find a lot of sort of more, I guess, genre TV when it does these hour long dramas. They feel like they're moving at this sort of propulsive rate, like they're almost scared to slow down.
Right.
And I've noticed that in Discovery. In some episodes, it doesn't faze me at all. In the last few, it hasn't. But in this one, where I'm expected to have an emotional connection to the story that's being told, I just it just felt like almost too superficial, and it was going too quick for me to even slow down and kind of bask in what these characters are going through.
Yeah, if like I think the method we got to the ending was, you know, a bit contrived, because like I said, we know Sarek is going to be fine. I think maybe they could have taken a calmer route,
right?
Like taking their time to get to kind of the conclusion they got to, which is, you know, Michael and Sarek kind of coming to terms with their own expectations of one another.
Right.
And that maybe the, you know, Sarek's lifeblood is spilling out of him route didn't really need to be the one we took with this episode. Because I actually don't think it built up too much tension.
No, I agree with that. And Cam, one of the things that I've said to you before off the mics, though, is that I don't feel any sort of sense of scale or urgency with regards to this Klingon war.
Yeah.
And I continue to not really feel that sense of urgency.
Right.
And this didn't really help it. Although I like the fact that this was a smaller episode. This yeah. felt like a smaller episode. Mm-hmm. And I'd put this in like one of my favorite episodes. We're only six episodes in, but I like this just because of kind of the scale, the smaller scale that it was at.
I agree with what you're saying in the sense of like, I like that it didn't feel sort of interchangeable from the other episodes.
Right. Because,
you know, the last three, which I've liked to varying degrees, some of them a lot. I really liked, you know, the Butcher's Knife episode. I thought that was fantastic. But there is a sense of like, because there's this arc, they don't stand on their own 2 feet. Like, they don't feel like individual Star Trek episodes, whereas this one did more so than really any of the others, except for the introductory 2 hours. There's just something about it that just, to me, it was like, it felt like it was a standalone, but not a very good one. Like, the stuff I really liked in this episode was more the character stuff, like with Lorca. Mm-hmm. I was way more interested in the Lorca story than anything to do with Sarek. And part of it for me is, I'm not really digging James Frayn's Sarek at all. Like, I just have zero connection to this take on the character.
Oh, okay. I really liked this Sarek. In fact, the first time I saw him on this series, I was actually really impressed with how much they nailed this casting. Like, he looks like Sarek.
You know, I've actually kind of been indifferent up into this episode, and there was a moment when they're doing that flashback Katra in the brain contemporary sort of scene.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh no, this is Mark Leonard. Like, James
really?
Brain. Yeah.
Interesting.
There was just like this one fleeting moment. I was just like, oh, he's got it. Like, he's really kind of like captured the spirit of Leonard here, and I totally dug it there.
To me, it just kind of feels like this very shallow take on the Vulcan. Like, I feel like Mark Leonard was a Vulcan. He showed up on set, they're like, good thing we cast a Vulcan as a Vulcan. Like, he just feels so in that character's skin that I completely believe him, whereas I just, this feels kind of like cosplaying to me. Like, I just don't buy it as, and this is an issue I had actually with a lot of the Vulcans on Enterprise as well. It felt kind of like, okay, actor, play a Vulcan, as opposed to these actors who just understood this from the inside out, you know, like Nimoy or Mark Leonard did.
Okay, but I say that they kind of resolved that by season 4 of Enterprise, because they explained why the Vulcans seem so different on Enterprise, and it made sense to me. And I think if you look at the journey of Saval throughout Enterprise, I buy it, and it all makes sense to me. And I maybe we'll have a similar journey, but like, oh, this is Sarek 10 years before we were introduced to him. I think that's kind of an interesting explanation as to maybe why he's different than how we meet him in Journey to Babel.
And maybe the issue for me is that this is the first real episode to feature Sarek in more of an active role. Like, he was in the introductory 2 hours, but it was more of kind of like flashback material and a mind meld sequence. It didn't feel like he was a real character so much as a plot device. And I don't feel like I know this Sarek well enough to be invested in him.
Okay.
Because to me, he feels so different than the other Sareks that I just can't connect to him as well. I'm still wrapping my head around him as Sarek.
But okay, let's take away the Sarek aspect, though. Let's talk about what we found about Burnham. Because you said you're more invested in the Lorca stuff. I was more invested in what was going on with the Katra connections, because we found out so much more of Burnham. And
it was the martial arts fighting, wasn't it?
Well, no. That was actually, maybe we have to talk about the production values, but that initial shot where like they're floating through space and it looked like...
It looked bad in the, Battle of the Binary Stars? I think that's the episode that did it, right?
Yeah. This looked worse.
It looked lousy there, and it looked lousy here.
Yeah. But I think with the Burnham stuff, though, like, I like the idea that she's been duped and she has been tortured for the last 7.5 years over something that really wasn't her fault, is because her father figure, daddy issues, guys, father figure had done this to benefit his own flesh and blood, as you said, Carmen.
Yeah. And I think we're going to see her maybe start to make a little bit of headway in this, but you can definitely see, looking back, a little chip on her shoulder. And I think she's, like, in the end of this episode, she definitely recognized, sort of a weakness in Sarek, maybe, and in that decision you made, and that I felt at the end of the episode that there is a little bit of headway that got made between the two of them.
Although she did reveal in the mess hall with her discussion with Ash Tyler that they didn't really chat about this entire issue. Like, she said, look, let's talk about it, Sarek. And we find out that they didn't really do that, which I think kind of jives with what we saw with the character as we first met him in Journey to Babel as well.
Definitely, yeah. I agree.
So, guys, Cam, you brought up the fact you liked the Lorca stuff more. What's going on with Lorca this week, sir?
Lorca's got PTSD, right? He's got issues.
And does PTSD stand for pretty...
terrific
sex dungeon? I don't know. Is that his quarters? I don't know. Lorca got lucky. That's what we know from this week.
Well, we've seen this character...
with an age-appropriate...
was shocking.
Yes. The fact that we have a captain of a starship having an age-appropriate partner, I guess we saw that with Sisko, but I mean, I don't know. I just keep thinking about Kirk and Picard having 25-year-olds.
Yeah.
And
the thing is, Jason Isaacs is... he's a good-looking, swaggering guy. It's not appropriate, but you could buy it in a sense. You could see someone like
you mean a woman with daddy issues, Cam?
No, but you
keeping with the theme of the episode.
You could also see someone like Lorca being attracted to that sort of woman, right? More so.
Are you talking about the admiral or the?
I'm talking about Lorca himself being more attracted to say admiral. Younger women, kind of being more of a womanizer.
Oh, I see.
Whereas, I liked this element to this character that we're seeing that he actually has close relationships to a certain degree.
Yeah.
Because it would have felt cheap to me, because I know Jason Isaacs had talked about how he was kind of channeling Kirk with this character. And that kind of made me a little nervous. We were going to see Lorca as sort of this womanizer. You know, he's a guy who lives on the edge, lives fast, you know. And you're like, oh, I know where that kind of character is going to go. But I like that we have Admiral Cornwell, who's this, you know, old friend of his and sort of a romantic interest. And we see the two of them together. And I really enjoyed this stuff.
Smooth jazz and drinking whiskey.
Yeah, I love this. I like this side of Lorca because for the previous episodes, he's seemed like a maniac.
Yeah.
This was the most human we've seen Lorca.
So, Carmen, do you think this means that maybe after the incidents on the Brian where Lorca self-destructed his ship to save his crew from Klingon torture, he is a fundamentally different man than the one that the Admiral had known for decades?
Oh, I think that's pretty obvious.
But he's putting on a bit of a facade right now, right?
Yeah, and I thought it was actually a little disturbing. I made a little note that while watching the episode, and it was, is Lorca sending the Admiral to her death?
Yeah.
I thought the same thing.
I figured the shuttle was going to blow up
or
something.
Too. Yeah.
Me too.
I think once threatened with his command being taken away, yeah, I think he's not the person that Admiral Cornwall knew back in the day.
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty obvious when she was shocked at his sleeping with a phaser under his bed. I wrote down also that I think he...
Cam does as well, but it's just because he's a big Star Trek fan.
So alone.
Well, you know, in case you need to open any locked doors in your house, you can just set it to maximum.
He mostly just aims it at the mice and goes pew, pew, pew.
I also live in a hovel. But, you know, I like the sense that we're seeing... I know they talked a lot about PTSD before this series started. They're like, this is a war story. You know, characters are going to go through emotional journeys that don't end at the end of an episode. And so I like that we're seeing a captain go through this. And this is the first time I felt a glimmer of hope for maybe this character to have a future on the series, in the sense that he is in a bad state and maybe it's going to be about him repairing himself. Like, you look at the previous 3 episodes featuring him, you're like, this guy is dying because he's crazy.
Yeah, but he's irredeemable, essentially.
Yes.
That's what you and I debated as well. It's like, this guy probably isn't making it to season 2 because where do you go with a character like this?
Right, yeah.
I don't know.
And this was the first time I thought, maybe this is a salvageable character in that regard. Now, the ending, I don't know, kind of tilts it back the other way, but...
Or no, he's like, Saru, Mr. Saru, we got to follow, like, procedure here. Like, let's, you know, let's not get too hasty about going on a rescue mission for one Admiral Carnwell.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I'm liking Lorca, and to me, this episode was great. I liked seeing him be charming. I did have a moment where he's like eating fortune cookies because, you know, it's in the family business. Question for anyone at the table. Who likes fortune cookies?
I mean, if they're there, I'll eat one.
Will you? I won't.
But I... Well, you're very... You have very particular habits when it comes to eating, Cam.
It's true. I'm also very picky.
You say picky. I've told you this before. I think you have an unsophisticated palate.
Sure.
Okay. Sure. Anyways, Carmen... If a fortune cookie is presented in front of you, will you eat it?
I'll eat it. And if no one else at the table will eat theirs, I'll eat theirs too.
Really? Yeah. That's very interesting to me.
I was born and raised in the deepest parts of East Van, and I grew up, my parents ordered Chinese food all the time, and fortune cookies were there. And as a kid, like, anything sweet is just awesome.
Now, Cam, if presented with Michelle Yeoh's skull, would you suck the meat off of her? Of it, as we found out they did in two episodes ago.
I think I would probably choose the fortune cookie in that scenario.
Okay, yeah. Is that why the episode was called Butcher's Knife?
Oh my god!
Wow,
we found out the Klingons were Klingons were eating one Captain Georgiou.
Yeah,
and just putting it out there.
But I wanted to get back to the Sarek story.
That's an awkward segue from that is an incredibly cannibalism, awkward story. But okay.
Yes. Because, you know, I agree with what you were saying in the sense of, like, how important this episode was for filling in sort of the gaps in Burnham's background. Because the show has been very vague about, you know, her place and what this exact relationship with Sarek is. My question to both of you is, did you like the way that this information was conveyed in these sequences in the mind meld?
So the ninja sequences?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think we could have done without the martial arts. If it was just like kind of the flashback stuff. But again, they were missing that sense of urgency, you know? Like, and it's tough because, you know, this character persists. He survives for another... into at least the 22 or 2371? Is that when he dies? Thereabouts? I think about 2371.
He dies in TNG.
Yeah. So he lives to at least 200. Yeah. We know that. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what did you think, Carmen, of like all the martial arts and all that sort of stuff?
If it's a metaphor for the struggle between the two mentally, it's pretty ham-fisted.
A little on the nose.
Yeah. There's lots of fists being thrown.
Oh, yes. it was impressive, like a lot of very well choreographed martial arts are, and I thought it was, but yeah,
was this like the raid?
It's like the raid. It's the Vulcan
the emotional raid. It felt very Matrixy to me.
Yeah, it did. It felt very Matrixy.
It's like plug in and start throwing punches.
Mm-hmm. Should we have had a scene where Amanda goes, "I know kung fu"?
No, she should have like blocked a punch and been like, "Whoa!"
Yeah, what do we think of Mia Kirshner as Amanda? This is a very different Amanda than I think we've seen from Winona Ryder or else the Amanda from the original series.
Yeah, Jane Wyman. A lot was made of the casting. Mia Kirshner is playing this role, and Mia Kirshner, actress who doesn't get a lot of acclaim. Like, you don't hear about her a lot. Like, I know she's really well known for the movie Exotica, an Adam Egoyan movie, which she's fantastic in. But she never really blew up, and maybe that explains why she's playing, you know, Amanda in this episode, and very forgettably. Like, I did not think that I think Mia Kirshner has talent because I've seen it in Exotica.
Yeah,
this was not a well-written performance.
It almost seemed as if she was doing a bit of a Valley Girl accent, and it threw me off versus how we've seen her portrayed in previous iterations. And
yeah,
I don't know if she was just like, hey, I need to take this character and do my own thing. I'm not going to bother with seeing what other actresses have done. I wouldn't blame her for not watching the Winona Ryder portrayal because this is a different timeline.
I don't even think Winona Ryder was that good.
I thought Winona Ryder was pretty good.
I've always felt like Jane Wyman was the only one who was given writing that really serviced that character well.
I thought Winona Ryder's character was given a lot more to latch onto, though.
Okay.
Yeah, like, Jane Wyman, how many lines did she have in total, do you think?
well, between the movies and I just feel like I got a better sense of that character.
She had like one
character.
Glimpse in Star Trek 3. Like we had one glimpse of her.
And 4 too. She's at the start of 4.
Two glimpses. Yeah. I don't know. I don't think she had much to do in the movies. We saw her a couple times. I think Winona Ryder probably screen time wise, probably at least equal if not more.
You don't think Journey to Babel, she gets quite a bit.
I think Winona Ryder probably gets more though.
Yeah.
I think Winona Ryder probably got like a good solid 5-6 minutes. I think Jane Wyman's probably around the same.
I think for me the issue is like I feel like Amanda is sort of the heart, whereas
yeah.
Sarek is the mind. And I never really got a lot of heart out of a Winona Ryder's performance, nor really Mia Kirshner's. Like, whereas Jane Wyman to me just like exudes like goodness. There's a sense like of like nurturing to that character, whereas I didn't feel that with the other.
I totally versions. Got that from Winona Ryder, though.
Did you?
Yeah, but Mia Kirshner, she did have a very emotional portrayal, though. It was in direct contrast to Sarek.
Mm-hmm.
What do you figure of this version of Amanda?
I thought it was very short. We really only saw her get angry at Sarek, or not angry at Sarek necessarily, but angry
she
at
was
the
exasperated
situation.
By yeah the was. Situation.
It dumbfounded her that someone as smart and as capable as Michael Burnham could have not made it into this.
Is this the first time that Amanda's been misled by her husband?
Oh, there's no way.
I really
sense
to,
no.
No, I'd really have to. Oh, you mean. Like, just, like, in general, you're not talking about, like, in episodes?
Just in general.
Okay, yeah, no.
Yeah.
No, like I said, I think Sarek, means well, but also has his, like, he's very prideful, and he has these little experiments he's doing, and I think I guarantee you he's done this in the past, where he's maybe lied to Amanda about something, just because he's like, no, it's, in his head, he's like, no, it's fine, the ends will justify the means.
Okay, yeah. I know you're not a big fan of the Sarek stuff in this stuff, but in this episode, but I think that this episode really made him a far more intriguing character to me, though. Like, just what we're finding out about his decision-making, these experiments that he's liking.
Right.
I'm not disagreeing
with the information that's conveyed in this episode.
It's just the execution?
It's the execution I thought was pretty lousy. Yeah.
Yeah, and I can't really argue with that with some of the...
In terms of the filling in stuff. The backstory, like I think when fans go on, you know, Facebook this week and are analyzing how Sarek's backstory fits in with Burnham's, and I think they did a really good job where I don't think you can poke a lot of holes and be like, that was terrible writing. I think they actually fleshed out in a way that's interesting and different, and at least kind of explains why Spock is more acknowledged going forward than Burnham. But it's more that just kind of how... It just felt really corny to me when you're having martial arts. Like, to me, I just kind of check out to a certain degree because I'm like, oh, this is just so... Yeah. It's pandering. You know, it's the sort of thing you would have never seen in a previous Star Trek series because they would have a certain amount of trust. And I don't want to play, like, old Star Trek versus new Star Trek.
Yeah.
But they would have a certain amount of trust in the intelligence of the audience that they don't need to watch martial arts fights to get to this stuff.
That's true. I think maybe... Like, I agree with you in that. I think maybe just like this episode as a whole, kind of the ending and what they're trying to get at, the point of the episode, wasn't really reached in the best way.
Like, yeah. I have no issue with where we wound up.
No, I like the premise and I like the conclusion, but sort of everything in the middle was weird. It was either...
Did it feel weird to you?
It did, yeah.
Yeah, like, I mean...
I'm not going to disagree with either of you guys, even though I'm a bigger fan of this episode. Yeah. I agree. It felt like a bit of an anomalous sort of episode.
Yeah. Like, this series has felt kind of strange, but I feel like episode to episode, I feel like the episodes themselves are fairly consistent tone-wise. Like, I'm on board with what I'm seeing for that hour. It's more when I look at the whole, I'm like, what is this series about?
Yeah.
But this episode, I was like, wow, there's so many weird things going on at once. And they don't feel like they're really meshing together very well. Like, the story of Lorca and this very human drama, you know, there's not martial arts fights in the Lorca story. You know what I mean? It's very, like, contemporary adult drama intermixed with this really weird approach to the Burnham-Sarek story.
No, I totally follow what you're saying there. And I get why you're saying you're more invested in what is going on in the Lorca story, though. Mm-hmm. So, okay. Some of the like, funnier, smaller... We've been talking about kind of the big, broad themes, but I think it's always funny to pick apart like what's going on the smaller scale, guys.
Definitely.
I got to give a shout-out. Issaquah Elementary School. I grew up in suburbs of Seattle. And so to hear that Issaquah Elementary School got a shout out, I don't even know if that's an actual elementary school, but I live next door to Issaquah, so it was pretty cool to hear that. Guys, anything you have to share about Issaquah, Carmen?
My mom and her whole family is from Shoreline, just north of Seattle.
Oh, I know Shoreline,
yeah,
too.
So Seattle's like a second home to me because half my family still lives there.
Okay.
And, you know, it was really, any time Seattle is mentioned or I'm very piqued, my interest is piqued, I have like an encyclopedic knowledge of who and what is from Seattle. So I really like that. I thought that was great. And Issaquah, you know, it's like someone threw a dart at the suburbs of Seattle because they could have mentioned.
I was from Sammamish. Like that's,
okay. Yeah.
So, cool. Cam, any Issaquah stories to share?
I got nothing. Okay. Vancouver born and raised. Yeah. But, you know, you're saying about Seattle, and that's related to the character of Ash Tyler, who we find out a little bit of backstory that he's from Seattle.
What else do we find out about Ash Tyler, Cam?
Nothing. That's why I want to talk about the character of Ash Tyler because, you know, Carmen, you weren't with us last week when we talked about the introduction of Ash Tyler. We're two episodes in now. When we were two episodes in on, say, a character like Stamets, we had a pretty good grasp on how we felt about Stamets, and he had an eccentric personality. How are you feeling about Ash Tyler after 2 hours?
I'm suspicious of him. I think there's something that's gonna come about with, like, he's gonna feature prominently in a plot at some point, maybe even like a big plot within the series. There's too many allusions to strangeness about this guy. Like, he survived the 7 months in the Klingon prison, and we figured out it's because the torturer took a liking to him. But, you know, Lorca was suspicious of him then. I'm suspicious of him still. There's just too much hidden. I think anytime Lorca pays attention to someone, I'm instantly suspicious of them. I really
like
want to know
the admiral. Yeah.
Yeah. And I really want to know what is going on, what he has planned for Burnham.
Yeah, because he has that line where he's sending Tyler out to pilot the shuttle pod carrying Burnham, and he says, "Bring her back, you know, without a scratch, or else don't come back at all." And I was like, boy, Lorca's really invested in Burnham all of a sudden.
And the whole expedition to save Sarek was really motivated by Burnham's personal history with him. So, yeah, I'm suspicious of...
And then he promoted her at the end of the episode to a science specialist.
Okay,
yeah.
Can we go through all of the different ranks we've witnessed with Michael Burnham at this point?
Yes.
So we're introduced to her. She's a commander.
Yes.
First officer aboard the Shenzhou. Then we get a flashback episode in which she's a Vulcan Science Academy graduate who's just coming aboard the ship. And then we get another image of her as the prisoner.
Right.
And then she jumps into a non-commissioned officer's suit.
Right.
She's just walking around in that. Now she's officially a science specialist. Yes. So that's about five different changes that we've seen in six episodes, guys.
Well,
yeah.
She's covering all the bases.
Yeah, that's why I want to think there's Lorca has like a plan for her.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Tyler, how just going back to Ash Tyler for a sec.
Yeah.
You know, do you feel like you've... I mean, look.
Do I have a grasp on who he is as a character?
I mean, and if he is sort of shadowy, as Carmen, you know, says, do you get a grasp at least on who this character is as a personality?
I think he is far less well-defined than any other character we've been introduced to on Star Trek Discovery.
Yeah.
And that, Cam, we're not going to spoil anything, but there's been a fan theory floating out and about Ash Tyler. And I say everything about this fan theory makes complete sense to me.
Yeah.
I think it's true.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, I hate it to its core.
Right.
It's everything I hate about like modern television, where you're trying to introduce things to make you rethink things, where it's kind of this mystery box format. And
that's J.J. Abrams' specialty.
I love the show Lost, but
right.
And I love the show, say, Mr. Robot as well. But it's like when you have Reddit detectives uncovering everything. You know, it was another big deal with Westworld, which is a very popular series that I have very mixed feelings on as well. But it's like you're trying to just unpack something instead of just absorbing it what it is. And it feels as if the show is trying to play a trick on the audience. And I don't like that. It fundamentally irks me. I have to believe that that's what's going to happen with Ash Tyler. And I would think it'd be lending itself to far more tension and urgency if the writers would actually let us in on, from the get-go, what is going on with Ash Tyler.
And, you know, this is an episode where we see, like, Burnham and Tilly starting to bond with this character. And, you know, when the episode ends, I'm like, boy, I like Burnham and Tilly.
Yeah.
Like, that guy's just a blank.
This Ash Tyler guy is, he's from Issaquah Elementary School.
And even if he is, you know, it's all conspiracy involving this character, you should at least make him someone that you want to watch. Like, let's say that, you know, he's, I don't know, like a bad character, for example. And we're now watching him be bad on the ship. You should still want to watch him. He should still be a character you're like, man, what is he up to? Like,
Landry was far more distinct.
Yes,
than
there you go. Like
guy.
A character, if he's like a character like Landry who's working for Lorca, you know, in a bad way, you want someone who's distinct that you're still invested in. Because look, there's the old saying, you know, like a genre thing is only as good as its villain. That's because villains are supposed to be charismatic and entertaining. So if Tyler is going to fall into that sort of camp or whatever he is, you want to be paying attention to him and be like, you want to find him magnetic so that if there is some sort of reveal with him later down the road, it means something. But if it's a blank character, you're like, who cares? It's like, you remember that Voyager episode where there was like the saboteur on the ship or whatever that Neelix uncovers?
That is one Mike Jonas.
Yeah, like tell me about Mike Jonas.
Investigations, I think, was the name of the episode.
Yeah, I think so.
I don't know how I can recall this, but Mike Jonas is a pretty boring character, though.
Right? And that was supposed to be a big reveal. And, like, who cares? Yeah. He was a boring character. So, like, I'm hoping, even though we're now 2 hours in with Ash Tyler, that if he's going to be a permanent member of the crew, great. If he's going to be some sort of conspiracy character, fine. But give me something so that I care.
I just even like little personality quirks, like he really likes making
beans.
Paper planes something.
Just, paper planes.
Just something distinct.
They can play MIA over it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's our outro music for this episode, Cam. Okay. But I agree. Like this. Out of the six main characters, two episodes into finding out who this character is, he seems like the least fleshed out at this point.
Dr. Culber, who's not even a, you know, opening credit character, I have more of a sense of than Ash Tyler.
Yeah, actually, we know how principled he is. We know his relationship with Stamets. Yeah, actually,
he's got
that's
some
two things.
Badass pajamas that I want.
Yeah, that's right.
And he has personality.
Yeah.
He's like a character I just like watching.
He's got a very, very well-groomed beard.
Oh,
like, I am jealous of that beard.
It's like a Frakes beard.
It is. Well, no, Frakes had a bit of a bushy beard.
But more in the sense of just like how groomed it is. Like, you can tell effort's being put in, and I appreciate
the
effort.
I dig it as well. Okay.
So, you know, Ash Tyler features in a sequence in this episode that I think could be controversial with fans who are loving the holograms on Discovery.
All the fans can't help but say, these holograms fit in well with this timeline, guys. Yeah.
So we saw, was it the holodeck? I don't know. They call it just a hologram simulation.
Yeah.
And it was a battle scenario against Klingons featuring Lorca and Tyler. And what do you guys think? Because there's, you know, the original series never quite established any sort of holodeck technology, even if it did exist.
Hey, Carmen, what do you think of this hologram simulation?
It's one of the very few complaints I have about Discovery. This kind of fits into it with this whole just not making the technology mesh well. Like, I get it. I get that we now live in 2017, so the idea of knobs and cranks and buttons on a starship is ridiculous. And I'm not saying we even should have, you know, Discovery should have gone back to that. But, like, the holograms, this pseudo-holodeck is very jarring for what we know about Star Trek. If we're living within, like, a Star Trek continuum of technology, this doesn't seem like it fits.
But I'll make the argument that they were probably making in the writer's room, which is this Discovery is the most advanced ship in the entire fleet.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's why it has this hologram simulator. And Cam, we saw in The Practical Joker from the animated series that there is a similar sort of holodeck-esque kind of technology that we have on these old Constitution class.
And that is sort
ships of
the out for the writers, I'm sure.
Yeah. So I saw it. I agree with you. I found it jarring at first because I knew exactly what was going on as soon as we saw them shooting all these Klingons.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, this is jarring. And then I rationalized it in my own brain and I went with it. Guys, what do you feel about the Enterprise shout out that we got in this episode?
It was great. I love it.
Yeah. I think those little small moments are like,
which one are you referring to?
So Tilly and Burnham are jogging and Burnham's explaining, hey, if you want to be on the right path to being a captain, you got to do this, eat right, get your, cardio up. and then you'll eventually get transferred onto a Constitution class ship like the Enterprise.
Oh, I thought you were referring to Enterprise, the TV series, not the actual ship.
Oh, yeah. We got the Jonathan Archer shout out last week.
Cool. I was like, what, was there a Phlox shout out or something?
Yeah.
That'd be pretty sweet.
That would be pretty sweet.
So, yeah, I'm down with the hologram. I'm not going to worry about it the way some fans are. I think there's far bigger things to criticize about Discovery than the look of the Klingons or how more advanced the technology is versus the original series era. One case in point, Cam, one of our friends online, Scott Hardy, gave us a shout out, sort of said like, hey, Tyler, Cam, what do you think of this particular post from Gabe Kerner, who's pretty much like the star of Trekkies, that documentary that won Denise Crosby directed.
You may remember him. He was the maybe like 13, 14 year old who had the fan film he was working on. He was very bright, very bright.
And he had like his own take on Discovery. And I agreed with a lot of the points. But these are the bigger things. And that I think the show has yet to justify why it's set in the era that it is.
Yeah.
I think if Brian Fuller was still on the series, it would have been very clear. But I'm just thinking in my own brain, like, we could have had this story that we've had so far set post-Nemesis. And I don't think that would have changed any of the themes or any of the narratives that we're tackling.
You wouldn't have had Sarek having to choose between Burnham and Spock.
Yeah, okay, but to me, that's not what the crux of this story is.
Right.
You know, Sarek's not even in the main credits, so I'm just kind of like, okay.
Yeah.
So I think that, but what I'm getting at is there are bigger things to debate about Discovery than, say, the technology being featured. Personally, I'm not super, super invested. I alluded to it earlier, but I'm not super invested in this Klingon war. I have no sense of scale. I have no sense of urgency.
I feel like Way of the Warrior did it better in like 2 hours on Deep Space Nine than this show has done in terms of making me care about a Klingon, Klingon versus Federation conflict.
But I thought the stuff on the Shenzhou, I thought that was kind of cool. I would much rather be hanging out with the crew of the Shenzhou repairing relay stations and Ensign Connor opening up wells on desert planets. Like that to me is kind of the Star Trek series I'd like. Because I'm just not simply invested in this Klingon war narrative that's going on. Are you guys connecting at all with the Klingon war stuff?
No. Yeah, not really. I mean, I think it's a lot of I think it's really calling back to Deep Space Nine, which was a very popular series, and maybe some of the people involved in Discovery early on when they were sussing all the stuff out, were like, oh, what can we take inspiration from in other Star Trek series? But I think you're right. I haven't really found too much purchase in this storyline.
The character moments, to me, that I've been digging from Discovery more so than the stories that they've been telling.
I will say I really like the character of Laurel.
Yeah.
And Vok. Like, I
agree.
I think they've made two really fascinating Klingon characters. Now, do you need the Klingon War to justify the use of those two? No. Not at all. Yeah. But, I mean, it just gives them a vehicle to kind of work within. And I'm liking Cole. We saw a little bit more of him. He's still a character we're seeing very little of. And I think
we'll see a lot more of him, though.
I feel like he's more important than they're letting on, but you know, like, I like these three Klingons. I think there's, like, a lot of potential for them. I'm not sure this was the way to use them. I think there might have been a more interesting way. I think you could have had, you know, these as sort of like radical Klingons who want to maybe break off to a certain degree because they don't agree with the Klingons being united with the Federation in like the 24th century if you're going to set it, you know, post-Nemesis. I think there's things to do there. I don't know. Like, let's just talk about, you know, sort of the ending of this episode. We see Admiral Cornwell being captured by the Klingons. What did you guys think of this Klingon appearance? And did it mean anything to you?
I like seeing Cole a lot. I thought that was great, but I don't know. I guess the next episode is them trying to deal with the aftermath of this, but it doesn't seem as if Lorca is...
He don't care.
He doesn't really care if he knows that the Admiral wants to take the ship away from him.
Yeah, it just was another piece in the Klingon War storyline that I'm not really sold on just yet.
Does it kind of feel like that season of Deep Space Nine? I guess it was season four and half of season five where they're at war with the Klingons, and it was only because the studio mandated it and the writers weren't fully invested.
It kicked off spectacularly, though.
I will not disagree with that. Yeah. No.
It was more the resolution where there's like, okay, we're back in.
No. Yeah, I think I might have mentioned, I think maybe I mentioned that in a previous episode I guessed it on, whereas, it felt like the ending was just kind of, we're back to where we started, guys.
It was literally Gowron putting his thumbprint on a pad.
Yeah.
It's peacetime now, guys.
Yeah. Right.
It's like, okay.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. This guy, I don't know. I feel it like the conclusion of this war is going to be very much like a thumbprint on a pad to a certain degree. I'm just like, okay.
Yeah, I think the more I think about it, the more I think we're so far with Discovery, we've gotten a lot of setup.
Yeah.
It's still very much we're setting up more of the series.
We're setting up all sorts of things because Stamets in this episode is acting insane.
Yeah.
And so we're setting up more, you know, like what's going on with Stamets. It seems like they're juggling a lot of balls on this series. And Tyler, you and I were talking the other night about series.
Stamets is acting, in your words, quote unquote, insane.
Well, he's acting a little strange. I was exaggerating.
But he's acting a little off from like the curmudgeon-y fellow that we know before.
Yeah.
We should discuss that, but I'm sorry, I interrupted. What were you saying?
Yeah, well, you know, we were talking about kind of like, what is the story of this series?
And I don't know.
Yeah, and I was saying like, it reminds me of Bates Motel, a series I liked a lot, which would introduce these sort of twists, but then resolve them in like two episodes. And so far, we've seen little bits of that, like the Ripper storyline, you know, is brought in. And I think at the time, we were like, is this where this series is going for the season? Like the
Ripper's taking the helm by the end of season one.
Like, is it going to be about the liberation of Ripper over 15 episodes?
Nah.
But, you know, it's, again, resolved in two episodes. So whenever I see things like the Stamets moment from the last episode, where it's him in the mirror, you know, with the kind of delayed double walking away, I'm like, is this a season-long thing or is this like a two-episode thing?
I think they'll have to address it by the next episode or at least before the mid-season premiere or mid-season break.
What did you guys think of Groovy Stamets?
I was digging it. I was curious what was going on there and why more people don't seem very concerned. You know, like he seems like he's high as F. At this point,
I think Lorca noticed.
But did he dismiss him from duty and send him off to Dr. Culbert?
No, I think he had other more pertinent things to do. But I noticed that when Stamets was acting a little off, Lorca did express interest in the way his facial expressions were. And then when Stamets moved off camera, off screen, Lorca kind of moved in that direction as well, and was only brought back to the planet at hand by Burnham speaking to him, and he turned back to her and then gave her the go-ahead for the mission.
Yeah.
But I think Lorca knows, and I think it's just another part of this serialized Star Trek where we're going to see it happen later. Like I said, I think there's a lot of setup we've been given right now and not a ton of climax or conclusion.
Yeah.
I also don't think Lorca's a good judge as who's fit for duty.
No.
So I can totally buy that he would just let Stamets slip by.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's letting Ash Tyler come in after being held captive for 7 months.
Yeah.
He's like, Stamets, go for it. Burnham, you're a prisoner. You're a mutineer. Starfleet's first. Do it. Tilly, you seem to be a little off. Go on this away mission. It's super scary. Landry, you're a psychopath. You're my chief of security.
Don't you dare put down Landry.
So I think... Is maybe Saru the only kind of smart, like on the surface at least, the smart, like reasonable choice that he's made when it comes to crewing everyone?
Seems to be, although he wasn't that good in the captain's chair last week.
No, actually, by the end of it...
He was at the end, yeah.
Cam, tell me, because we talked about this. This is probably like your favorite Saru scene that...
And not mentioned on the podcast.
Yeah, we forgot about it. Yeah.
You know, we were in San Francisco. We had weird equipment. Everything was a little off, but but we totally forgot about this moment. I loved it, which is that what Saru does to kind of save Lorca at the end is... His survival instinct kicks in, and he recognizes the difference in the pattern of Lorca's ship. That, you know, predators work in packs, and this ship is not fitting into this pack well. And so that is like a solution that only this character could have had. And I think that shows a lot of value for the character that maybe previously didn't exist, where they would be like, "Well, he's not a very good captain." Right. But we see that he has abilities that no other character on that ship would have had.
Guys, I'll throw a question at it. Not a trick question or anything like this, but let's go through the main cast, the six main characters.
Ooh, okay. I like this sort of stuff.
Well, I'll start with Carmen, then I'll go. Next question will be Cam. Carmen, what nationality is Lorca?
Ooh, isn't he...
It's not a trick question.
No, isn't he from, like, the South?
Yeah. See, yeah. He seems like he's American, right?
Yeah, he's American.
Cam, what nationality do you think Burnham is?
Well, she's African-American, maybe?
Well, so American.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Carmen, what nationality have they established Ash Tyler to be?
Oh, well, I'm American. He's an Issaquah boy.
Okay. Cam, Tilly.
Tilly? American?
Stamets. Carmen?
Oh, yeah, seems American.
So 5 out of 6... main cast members on the show, they're all American.
Yeah.
Is this, like, very odd for Star Trek? I've never seen, like, this before.
What about the original series? Well, you had the... No, that's not true, actually, yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Not Next Gen.
No, not Next Gen.
What up?
Not DS9.
Enterprise?
Not really, no. The only Americans were Archer and Trip. Yeah. Or maybe Mayweather, but I think Mayweather was actually born in space.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well,
to me, it's just weird that this show is as for great as it is for diversity, and we've seen like a lot of these cool like side characters, like the people at the helm or what have you. Like everybody except for Saru is American. Like, yeah. It's very strange for Star Trek to do that, and I really didn't put the pieces together until they said that Tyler's from Issaquah.
Wasn't Burnham born on born on the Vulcan colony?
Yeah, that's where I get confused.
She may have been born in the Vulcan colony, but I assume she's of American extract.
She definitely isn't speaking with an English accent like, the tactical officer on Enterprise, help me out.
Oh, Reed.
Reed, thank you. Yeah completely right. Blanked, yeah.
Although, this is a franchise where we have a Brit playing a Frenchman.
Right.
So, I don't know, things get a little
bit messy.
Well, that's
where Lorca gets really weird.
Yeah, we have a Brit playing a Southerner.
With a Spanish name.
With a Spanish name, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Whose family made Chinese fortune cookies.
Yeah, okay, that was really weird.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they did it for centuries, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Sure.
I don't quite follow, but we all know that Alabama's known for their... Chinese cuisine.
Fortune cookie exports.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't know. Just like one of my little thoughts here. Guys, any closing thoughts that we have on this episode? Anything that you want to cap off with?
Well, I'm curious, Carmen, we're 6 episodes in. Was this episode encouraging for where the series is going?
Yeah, I like to talk about the things I thought were curious about the series in this podcast. But overall, I'm very much enjoying it, and I think each episode really does. If I have little quibbles with them, I think it does give me hope for more episodes. I'm just very excited to be watching Star Trek Weekly again.
Who's your favorite character at this point?
That's a really good question. I really like Michael Burnham, and I really like Tilly, and I really like the friendship they're getting. I have
mentor mentee,
yeah. And I really have to Saru needs to be sold to me a lot more.
What did you think about the last episode, though, Choose Your Pain? That is a very Saru-heavy episode.
Yeah, it was. And it was... I actually find him kind of tragic. I really don't think he likes being on Discovery.
I think, would you?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't. I think he is a Federation purist. The Starfleet is a science organization. Exploration organization, and I think he's on Lorca's ship, and Lorca's very much not like that. I mean, he refers to Ash as soldier when he first meets him.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think Saru is actually, I think he's stressed out, and I don't think he likes where he is. I don't think he likes that his former friend, Burnham, or his former, was a mutineer and kind of manipulated him emotionally a couple episodes back. So I think he's kind of a tragic figure right now, but I still don't really, beyond that, I don't really... dig him too much.
Cam, your favorite characters at this point?
I would say Burnham. I would have said Landry, but she's gone, left me forever.
You're a Fandry.
I would say like
or a Camdry.
No, that's what my fans are called. Yeah. there are none.
No one calls himself that.
There's no one wearing a shirt that says Camdry.
Yeah.
like, I want to love Saru. The show is just not quite giving me enough yet. You know, like, this episode, he's barely in it. I would say that Burnham and Stamets are the two that I'm gravitating the most for. I'm also, like, Saru and Lorcar kind of in the same boat, where I'm like, I want to love this character, and the show is just not quite giving me, I don't know, that hook that really pulls me in.
My sense is we're going to get an episode that's going to, you know, push us over the top when it comes to Saru.
Though. Yeah, I think he's sticking around for the long haul, as long as this series goes, so I'm not too worried about him not being explored in the future.
Yeah.
But Lorca is more of a question mark, I guess.
Anyway, I'm digging Stamets. I've established that before. Mm-hmm. I think Saru is the last episode that really sold to me. There's a certain aloofness to Burnham. I just haven't been able to connect with her. I actually really dug her in the first two episodes. Like, I was like, yes, this is my favorite character. But as we've just spent more time with her, she has her guard up to a certain degree that we did not see in those first two episodes. And so I just feel more detached from her than I did in the Vulcan Hello and Battle at the Binary Stars. And
right.
So I'm hoping she's able to, you know, break down those barriers as we go throughout the season, and I become more attached to her once again.
Well, she was like a very active, outgoing character in that two-parter,
yeah.
Whereas since then we've seen her, as you said, kind of defensive and not sure of her place in the world that is the Discovery. But, you know, I'm looking forward to kind of thawing out that character more and getting to... I want to see her become that sort of flagship character of the series that, you know, Kirk was, or, you know, Picard, or like a character that we are firmly on board with. But, you know, like, I just want to say, like, this episode, while it's not one of my favorites so far of Discovery, I like that it felt different. You know, I was getting a little concerned that, I think I even said this to you, like, I was worried that at the end of the season, I'd be like, well, I can't tell any of the episodes apart.
Sure.
Other than, like, a minor beat, like, that's the episode where Ripper's introduced or something like that. Whereas I feel like this episode stands on its own to a certain degree, and at least in the sense it stands out. Like, I will remember the martial arts Sarek episode, but I'm hoping for...
That was a cut scene that Mark Leonard just wasn't able to do back in the early 90s, but, you know.
We can do CG doubles now.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping for more episodes like this in the coming weeks that maybe kind of meet my requirements a little more.
Okay, like a better balance.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
So, you know, before we move on to some feedback, Tyler, it's time to summon the great ship Ortonville.
Oh, yeah.
With his thoughts on the latest episode of the Orville. What was it called again?
The Krill.
Okay.
Or, no, I think it was just called Krill.
Krill. Okay. Yeah. So, how was it, Tyler?
I think it was like their best episode yet.
Really?
Yeah. You know, which isn't, I mean.
Was it their best of both worlds?
Perhaps. Yeah. Well, in that, very much like in Best of Both Worlds, where we see Picard be consumed by the Borg, we see Ed Mercer go in disguise as a Krill.
Oh, so it's kind of like what's the episode from
Apocalypse Now?
Yes.
Or Apocalypse Rising, rather.
Yes, Apocalypse Rising.
Yeah, it's very much like Apocalypse Rising.
Okay.
So we have Ed Mercer and Malloy, the helmsman. They go in disguise as Krill. And to me, it was a good enough episode, except it emphasized to me that Seth MacFarlane just does not have the gravitas to be a leading man. He is a good-looking guy. He's a smart guy. He's charismatic, but he doesn't have that kind of anchor quality that you need from somebody who's going to lead a series. And so you have him doing this stuff, and it just kind of, like, I think he works so much better as, say, a side character. There's other stuff that it constantly irks me about how subconsciously misogynistic this show is. I don't think Seth MacFarlane's trying to be overtly misogynistic, but like, we're introduced to our first female Krill character aboard this ship that they infiltrate. Her job is she's the teacher. She's the school teacher. And it's just like...
The Keiko.
Well, exactly. It's just kind of like, oh, really? Like, you're going to give her the stereotypical woman job.
Right.
You know? And I'm just like... I don't know. Like, I've said it before. Look, I know a lot of Star Trek fans are watching it and enjoying it. It's just not a show for me, but there's this curiosity factor. I'm going to keep tuning in the rest of the season. And this was like miles better than the last two episodes, which I thought I just like cringeworthy for me. But that's the Ortonville report for this week, guys.
Carmen, have you been watching the Ortonville?
No, I've gotten so, I've like, this is the king of all mixed reviews for me. Like, not even joking. I have like so many different reviews of it coming from every angle, and to be honest, my media consumption menu, diet, whatever, has been really overloaded lately. So I just haven't had a chance to give it a shot.
You've just been watching Gerald's game on a loop, right?
Over and over and over.
Yeah.
else? What other time of the day is like? What else is there in the day?
Nothing for me. I mean, I've been looping that new Netflix movie nonstop. So.
Okay, so now for some of the incoming transmissions from this week. We had a video up on YouTube talking about, is Harry Mudd appropriate for Discovery? And we had some really good comments. Kimberly says, I agree that there wasn't really anything bad about Rainn Wilson's performance on Discovery. I think they handled it the best possible way, and it brought a lot to the story. But the issue is having this reintroduced TOS character in the first place. TOS Mudd is beloved by many fans. I don't think they will like this edgy reinterpretation. TOS Mudd is also disliked by many fans. We don't want to see him portrayed as some kind of voice of the people. I'm absolutely interested in moral debates about Federation ethics, but not from a future human trafficker. Carmen, I'm curious, where do you stand on the reintroduction of Harry Mudd last week?
It didn't do a ton for me. It wasn't the Harry Mudd that I had known from the original series. This one seemed a lot more mercenary. Oh, I guess he was pretty mercenary. I don't know. He seemed more callous, and I really raised an eyebrow at his mention of, you know, how the Federation ignores the little people, which I was like, I kind of came out of left field. And it's something I've noticed they sometimes do, especially in the later Star Treks, where they kind of make the Federation out to be this, like, just a lot more sinister than it is. And it's like the Federation, you know, it's done things like eliminated poverty and given everyone like a chance to kind of fulfill their own desires or fulfill a greater purpose.
But at what cost, Carmen?
Everybody has to work in a mining colony for at least 5 years, based on what I've seen on Star Trek.
Yeah, oh, you're not allowed to traffic women, and Mudd's really cheesed about that. Like, I don't know. I felt it was kind of just out of left field, and it was a nice little nod, and I actually like Rainn Wilson's performance of that character. That character in the show, but you know, wasn't necessarily.
I liked Rainn Wilson's performance, but this is not a character I ever needed to revisit ever again.
But if it was, like, it could have been done a little better. Maybe it even could have been like a little bit of like a jovial. Oh, you know, again.
No, but my problem is like this is a sex trafficker.
I know,
and it's just
immensely regret it.
I know, no, but it's kind of like, and people are like, oh no, this is before he becomes a sex trafficker. I'm just like, but there's still this reverence that you're gonna have to hold over him, so it just, the character fundamentally does not work for me at all.
And in a franchise as continuity obsessed as Star Trek, it's weird going from this dark take into those like very campy, lighthearted TOS episodes. It's kind of like, you know, the Bond franchise is a continuity nightmare, and they know it, and they kind of play it up.
Yeah.
But it's like watching a Roger Moore one, like Moonraker, and then like watching it back to back with like one of the darker Connery ones. You know, it just doesn't, like From Russia with Love, it just doesn't make sense, but who cares? That's a continuity joke. They kind of play that up. Star Trek is always like obsessed with continuity. So it becomes more of a head-scratching and just more fodder for fans to be pissed off about.
Well, I can't wait for Discovery's portrayal of the White Rabbit from Shore Leave. It's going to be super, super brutal.
So I want to get to another comment from Andrew Gilbertson. He says, and this is in regards to the F-word being dropped on Choose Your Pain. He says, I agree that it's a lazy writing tool to drop the F-bomb and an ill fit to the Star Trek universe. I feel like it is also a non-family show issue, and that really bothers me. But I think Discovery already went there a long time ago, so it's one more nail in the coffin. I would in no way show my kids Discovery, and they've seen TOS, TNG, and Voyager. I wouldn't show them Discovery, and then brackets, well, ever, because I think it's terrible, but if I were going to, and end of bracket, until the later teens at least. As a parent, I find the direction of 21st Century Trek lamentable. I grew up sharing TNG with my dad. Discovery, and even certain swaths of Enterprise, are not something fit to share with my own kids. And this is an issue I definitely brought up a while back on the show, and that, you know, Tyler, you were very young when you discovered Star Trek. Like, was it 8 years old or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, to me, Star Trek is a franchise built on morals and messages that works because it pulls you in with sort of the space opera type aesthetics. and like I just don't see this working for children. Like it's not something like I think Star Trek was so good because it was something families could watch and parents could get something completely different out of it than kids could. And Discovery is a show that to me seems pitched almost solely at the adults.
But to me, it just seems as if the F word doesn't work in this universe. Like I just, I thought it was weird. Like, you know, I'm not a prude at all. I'm just like, I drop F bombs every day.
Every day. It's just a nonstop stream of them.
You should hear me when I'm at the drive through window. It's it's embarrassing. But I mean, just me, it just seems weird in the Star Trek universe.
Yeah.
And I found it off putting. And I think, honestly, like, I sound just so like, you know, Helen Lovejoy-esque when I from The Simpsons, of course, where it's like.
I thought you meant your neighbor.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's like. I think this should be for children. I can understand why parents would be very, reluctant to expose their 8-year-olds to F-bombs, you know?
Although this is also an episode where someone got curb stomped. No one's bringing that up.
No, yeah. But you know, I think there's a hypocrisy here. And like people are perfectly fine with violence, but if you have sex or language, then oh no, you know, I bet a lot more people had problems with, you know, Lorca and the Admiral getting it on versus... I don't know, watching all that Vulcan green blood splatter all over Sarek.
Or those Klingons, like, slitting the throats of the Federation. Yeah.
That's a much better example. Yeah. I don't know. Carmen, F-bomb?
Yeah, it...
No, I want you to say an F-bomb.
Oh, F-bomb.
Okay, thanks.
Yes.
It felt forced. Yeah, and I was like...
Yeah, that F-bomb you just dropped, you did.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you're right.
Very much so.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. Like, I go back and forth, because obviously they want to aim at a more adult sort of prestige TV audience.
Yeah.
But at what cost?
I know.
Because it's sort of like serving a specific audience but not thinking of the future. You know, like who are the kids that are going to be carrying this franchise forward?
But you know what? Give it 10 years. I bet teachers in kindergarten are going to be dropping F-bombs because it's socially acceptable by then. So.
Or there'll be a new Star Trek by then that's so much more like, it's like hardcore porn. And they're just like, remember the days of Discovery when it was for families?
did you just say hardcore as in Harry Mudd hardcore porn?
Yeah.
And on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Join the discussion over at our Facebook account at facebook.com/subspacepod. We had a lot of great discussion about last week's episode, Choose Your Pain. Hopefully there'll be a lot about Lethe. And you can also see links up there to like our blogs. Tyler, what did you talk about this week?
Yeah, I took a look at a very forgettable sort of Star Trek two-parter, Gambit. In which
so forgettable that when we talked about it on the episode, we didn't even figure out what episode it was.
We thought it was Redemption, but that's when Data had command of a ship.
No, we said Unification. First we said Redemption, then Unification.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was, in fact, Gambit, in which he had command of the Enterprise, and Worf was his first officer, and Worf was just riding up on him, being very disrespectful of Data. And I was like, oh, these are interesting comparisons to what we're seeing with Saru trying to be authoritative with this crew. And so it was a fun... Choose Your Pain v. Gambit kind of comparison that we had on the most recent blog. Cam, what did you talk about?
Well, I talked about the comparison between Stamets and the Invisible Man because watching last week's episode, I didn't really feel like writing about Harry Mudd or prison escapes, but the Stamets story is really interesting to me because it's a character we're seeing kind of succumb to the temptation of tampering with Mother Nature, if you will, and I began to wonder, is this character undergoing a mad scientist arc? I'm beginning to think that seems to be the way we're going, given this week's episode, so you can read more of my thoughts on that sort of topic and how it relates to the 1933 version of The Invisible Man over at, just head over to our facebook.com/subspacepod site, and you can find those links there. Now, I guess next week we'll be back with the next Discovery episode called Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad. Which, who do you think the man is, Tyler?
I think it's Stamets.
Yeah.
But you think...
I said Lorca initially, and then you said Stamets, and I felt like an idiot.
Yeah.
So I think it's Stamets.
Okay, okay. Yeah.
So maybe
Who do you think? You're going to be the tiebreaker now, Carmen.
I think there's going to be a stowaway, and he's going to be insane.
Okay.
Or will Ash Tyler finally have something to do that's interesting?
Yeah.
That'll be magic.
That's true.
That would be magic. Okay, you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Veg Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's REPORTONN as in not quite Vulcan.
And you can find me at Carmen Live. That's Carmen with an I, as in interplanetary Katra messaging.
And now, Carmen, you also have a podcast you're many episodes into. Why don't you just kind of give your pitch?
Yeah, I do. I'm on the podcast called Adventured EXE. And you can find us on iTunes, on Podbean. We're a live play Dungeons and Dragons podcast. We keep it light, and it's very comedy themed rather than hardcore. And episodes are an hour or less, so pretty digestible.
Awesome. Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.